All right. So people are working their way back to their seats. When they come back, tell them that they missed the part where I came out and did a cartwheel on stage, because that's what you get for coming back late. We have a jam-packed agenda this afternoon and a lot to get through. We're going to start with a scientist who's joined us from Microsoft AI and Research, Sarah Jane Dunn. She's going to talk to us about biological computation. We're also going to talk this afternoon about DevOps. We're going to talk about artificial intelligence and bots as well. So without further ado, which is my favorite line to use, let me introduce Sarah Jane, who came here from the UK. Please give her a warm Warsaw welcome.
Thank you. Okay. Right, it's a really pleasure to be here today. And I thought, because the focus of this conference is new tech, that I would present to you today what, in my humble opinion, could be the future of tech in years to come. And actually what I would say could form the basis of the next scientific revolution in the 21st century. Now, funnily enough, this kind of innocuous lump of metal is actually the reason we're all here today. This is silicon. And the latter half of the 20th century was completely transformed by this one material. Not only do companies like Microsoft owe their existence to this material, but it's made possible technologies that have fundamentally changed the way the world works. And obviously what I'm talking about are all these electronics that are in our phones, in our PCs, in our tablets, in our cars, airplanes, smart TVs, and the HoloLens. All of these enabled by the fact that we can write software that runs on silicon. Now, back when someone first programmed on silicon, I'm willing to bet that they had no idea that one day the internet would exist. And I'm really willing to bet that they had no idea of the kinds of companies and industries and technologies that would emerge. All of these things that have redefined how we communicate, how we shop, how we work, how we exercise, and even how we eat. So do you think 20 years ago, 30 years ago, anyone would have predicted Uber or Twitter, Instagram? I still don't get Snapchat, but that might just be my age. So it kind of begs the question, what about the 21st century? Is there another scientific revolution on the way? Well, I think that there is, but I think that it's going to have something, it's going to have to be a revolution that's going to have to tackle a whole host of global challenges that we're facing, challenges that are unique to the time that we're living in because of the demands that we're placing on our environment and on each other. You've already heard about the challenges that we're facing now in health and medicine because we're living longer and longer, and the consequence of that is we're getting more age-related diseases like Alzheimer's and cancer. We're facing challenges in food production and agriculture because we're starting to feel the first effects of climate change. And we're facing challenges in how to power this increasingly energy-greedy planet. And all of this for an increasing population of people. Again, you've already heard, we're set to be 10 billion people on this planet by 2050. All of these people are going to need to be kept healthy and well-fed. They're going to need access to all of these modern technologies that we're developing, and those technologies, they're going to need to be powered somehow. So what kind of scientific revolution could allow us to tackle these kinds of global problems? Well, I started off by telling you how one material has fundamentally changed the way that we live nowadays. And I think that the 21st century could be changed by one material again, but by this material, biology. So imagine with me if one day we could program your immune system. This could revolutionize the pharma industry, because rather than talking about prescription medications, we would instead construct programmable molecular devices that can be inserted in cells, allowing us to program your immune system like we program a computer. Imagine that one day we could program plants, even a simple potato crop. And as a consequence of that, allow this plant to be resistant to drought or to fungal infection. That could allow us to feed this ever-growing population. And in so doing, it could transform the agricultural sector. And imagine that one day we could generate 1 billion artificial trees that run artificial photosynthesis. We'd have realized a clean, renewable source of energy that could be used to power all of these PCs, tablets, phones. So what I'm talking about is the concept of living software. And it's not such a crazy idea, because like all of the computers and phones that we're using every day, cells themselves, the cells in your body, perform computation. This simply means they process information. But cells don't run on transistors made out of silicon. They have to use their biochemistry to execute their programs. Information processing is everywhere in biology. You can think about something as simple as a white blood cell, which you can see in this video. It gradually seeks out to engulf a fungus in order to fight the infection. It's very difficult to argue that this just isn't information processing, allowing your immune system every day to stop you. Well, it's the only thing that stands between you and the grave, isn't it? You could think about a plant. It's like a tree. Every day, a tree has to kind of wake up and decide how it's going to allocate its resources. Is it going to grow, photosynthesize, compete with its neighbors for soil or light? This is a problem that the plant has to solve at the level of the whole organism, but a plant doesn't have a brain to coordinate it all. So somehow, cells in the plant are taking in information about the plant's state and making decisions that affect the whole organism. And we can think of something as simple as carbon fixation. Okay, so maybe it's not so simple. But carbon fixation, the process by which plants take in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. This is regulated by cells that control the size of pores on the leaves of a plant. And if a pore is open, then it can allow carbon dioxide to get into the plant, but water will inevitably be lost. Somehow, the plant has to manage the amount of water it will lose while maximizing the amount of carbon dioxide it can take from the environment. And so these individual cells that are controlling the size of the pore are taking information in about time, humidity, temperature, light. And then they're controlling the size of that pore in concert with all of the other cells around them to manage the behavior of the whole plant. The challenge remains, however, to actually figure out what this biological computation is, to explain how cells process information in order to make decisions about whether they'll divide or die or move. And part of this challenge is we're not really trying to do this in biology at the minute. And some of you could be forgiven for thinking I might be trying to mislead you, because we have had a lot of success in biology and we know a lot about what's going on in cells. You could say there's been 50 years of success in molecular biology, but actually, there's a great gap between all of the data that we have about biological systems and our understanding of what those systems are actually doing. And if you don't believe me, maybe you would believe the editors of the journal Cell, which is probably the most high-profile biological journal. And in this quote, they say hundreds of pathways, thousands of cell types, tens of thousands of molecules, megabytes of data, and seemingly infinite biological networks. The study of life has never been so daunting. And this was in 2014, and I know megabytes of data doesn't sound so big to most of you in the room, but that'll have grown since then, and it's pretty big when we're just talking about biological data. So it's a pretty neat summary of the state of affairs that we're facing, and it helps set the scene for what should be recognized as the biggest problem facing biology. So to try to explain how we're struggling to get this understanding of information processing, I'm going to borrow an analogy. And this analogy was put forward by a Russian biologist named Lazebnik. And he asked a simple question, which was, if I gave a biologist my broken radio, how would they set about trying to fix it? So this is really an analogy to help you understand the kind of the way we work in biology. The first job would be to get our hands on a large supply of identical but functional radios. And the idea of this is that you dissect these and try to compare them to the one that's broken to see if you can figure out what's different. And then you'd have to spend a lot of time to get the tools to open up the radio. Actually, there's probably a couple of Nobel Prizes in there just to get that radio open. And once it's open, you would see all kinds of different objects. And so you'd set about trying to classify these objects. You'd say, okay, I've got the family of round black objects and red cylindrical objects and black slightly long, slightly stretchy objects. And once you'd got your kind of catalogue of what these components are, you'd wonder to yourself, well, what happens if I break one of these? Does the radio stop working? And sure enough, there might be a couple of components that if you break them or remove them in some way, that the radio stops working. And that'll get a postdoc, probably a tenure position at some university. And we call them phenotypes in biology, the idea that you can change the function of the system by affecting one part of it. But the result of this is a huge amount of data. You've already got your catalog of components, and now you've got a list of all the kind of possible consequences of removing one component. And so the question is whether or not that kind of information could help us fix the radio. And it might be that it could if it turns out that in your working radio, you have a red cylindrical object, and in your broken radio, that's black and smells like burnt paint. That kind of suggests that maybe replacing the red object in your broken radio could fix it. And that kind of thinking underlies the typical approach in pharma, reflecting the idea of give me a target, that there is some miracle target, and the malfunction of that target is responsible for the disease. But like a radio, cells have tunable components, and it could be that several components are broken and it's not reflected in their appearance or in their connections. And then suddenly we're at a bit more of a loss. We don't have the right kind of information to fix the radio. But in this context, a trained engineer could. And the difference here is that trained engineers have formalized standard languages that allow them to unambiguously understand a diagram that describes a radio or any other electronic device. Their language allows them to identify patterns or modules in those diagrams. And they describe the processes that generate the function in the object, in the radio in this case. So an engineer could fix the radio or any other device. And we can make this maybe a bit more relevant to what we're familiar with. So we can imagine software that encodes something like Groove or iTunes or Spotify. And I'm fairly confident that no one in this room, if Groove broke one day, would start lifting off keys off their keyboard to see if that fixed the problem. You'd just go straight to the code because you have an understanding of what drives this system, how this system works. And so in the analogy, we've downplayed really how amazing the experiments are that we've carried out in biology. And it does downplay all that we've uncovered and the amazing intellect that's gone into this field. But the idea is more just to highlight that we've yet to bridge this gap between the fact that we've accumulated a wealth of data, but we really haven't been able to translate that into an understanding of how to repair biological dysfunction or even design something new or more specialized. So then the question is, okay, well, how do we actually go about uncovering biological computation if the typical approach isn't really getting us there? And so what I thought I'd do is use an example from my own research. I work in an area of biology known as stem cell biology. And so the question that we've asked in my work is, what is the biological program that governs development? So here's your very brief biology lesson. You start off life as a very kind of, as a small group of cells, and in that group of cells are what is known as embryonic stem cells. Now, these are only around for a very short period, but they're really special because they can generate all of the adult cell types in your body. We call them naive. They're naive enough and potent enough to generate a heart cell, a lung cell, a brain cell, you name it. And that's amazing, because you think, well, hold on, if we could get our hands on these cells, then we'd have an amazing resource. If we could figure out how to push them in the right direction, then we could make whatever cell type that we're interested in using for therapy. But the problem we have is, as I said, they don't hang around for very long, so you can't get at them so easily. Yours are long gone, by the way. And also, we don't actually understand yet how they choose to differentiate. So differentiate, is the process of making a new cell type. Now, excitingly, some research in the last decade actually figured out a way of taking your adult cells and turning the clock back, so turning them back into this embryonic stem-like state. It was actually called reprogramming cells, and this is how biologists refer to it now. And this was some Nobel Prize-winning work from a Japanese stem cell biologist. So what's exciting about that is it holds the potential for us to take your skin cells, turn them back into embryonic stem-like cells, and then differentiate them from there. So it kind of helps us to solve one of these problems, and we just need to figure out how we push these stem cells in one direction or other. But the only challenge that remains with that is that this so-called reprogramming is actually very inefficient. The first results, only 0.01% of the cells actually converted, and it's not got a huge amount better than that. And actually, again, we don't really understand how it works. So the goal is to try to figure out what the biological program is that can govern this differentiation away from the embryonic stem-like state, and then also figure out if we can explain how to get back there in the first place. So the variables of this program are the important thing to figure out first of all. And often in biology, we generate these huge so-called interactomes. And I've got an example on this slide where you have a bunch of nodes, which are typically genes or proteins, and then we have all of the possible connections that can exist between those components. And some of you might already clock that, you know, while this is quite descriptive, it falls short of being explanatory. And while it's very comprehensive, it certainly falls short of being predictive. So we need to do a little bit better than this. And again, it's this idea that we need a rigorous formal representation of what's happening in the system that can explain the dynamic information processing steps that are occurring over time and which can recapitulate what we see the system doing. So we need a kind of modeling formalism for this program. And because we're dealing with genes interacting with one another, it's quite simple to use a logical modeling formalism. And actually, of that, we can simplify further and just think of something called a Boolean network. Now, this just describes the state of each gene as being on or off. And so you can have a bit vector that describes the state of the entire system. And then you have interactions between these components that say how a gene might activate or inhibit another gene's expression. But we have a challenge in this, which is that experimental data often can only say that an interaction might exist. So we have to allow for some kind of uncertainty. And so to tackle this, we introduce the idea of an abstract Boolean network. And so you can see now some of the arrows on this are dashed, which means we're saying, I'm not sure. The data suggests this interaction could be there, but it's not confirmed. Or I don't really trust my PhD students, so their data could be a bit dodgy. Or this other person's published something which contradicts what I've done. All these reasons, it might be useful to say, OK, I'd like to explore the possibility of that. And so if you have an abstract Boolean network, you're implicitly defining a number of concrete Boolean networks, which are shown on the right, each of these having a unique topology by all of the different possible instantiations of the possible interactions. And the second challenge that emerges from this is that actually different networks can produce the same behavior. So somehow we have to either discriminate between the networks or figure out a way of reasoning about the whole set of networks until we can eliminate one or other. And this shows us actually, yes, we might need to consider the set of models as a collection and work with that set. So we need the tools to do that. So ultimately, what this boils down to is a challenge to synthesize only those models that can produce experimentally observed behavior. And the idea is this: if you think about us trying to develop a program, we can use our experimental observations, our experimental data, to write down program specifications. And then we could use those specifications to try to construct a program. So the equivalent in biology could be, okay, I've seen that if gene A is active, then gene B is active or gene C is active. And because we're working in this logical modeling context, we can express that as a logical formula, which is our specification. And then we can generate networks that are consistent with those formulae. And we can write more and more complex formulae, as you can see. And so the idea that we applied here was to move from tools that are typically used in software verification to try to apply this to this kind of problem of reprogramming cells back to the embryonic-like state. And actually, we chose to use tools that are typically used to search for bugs or to verify the correctness of software programs. Only now, we're using them to verify the correctness of biological programs, trying to ensure that our biological program is consistent with our experimental specifications. And more specifically, we chose to utilize a technology called Z3, which is an automated theorem prover that's used across a lot of Microsoft tools. And this allows us to check the satisfiability of those logical specifications. And we embodied all of this in a tool that we call RAIN, which stands for the Reasoning Engine for Interaction Networks. And this is just a snapshot. It's a cloud-based tool. And what you can see on the left-hand side of this is the abstract Boolean network that you enter in. And then you enter in as well a set of experimental specifications. And what RAIN will do is synthesize only those models that are consistent with the specifications. And that's that kind of Space Invaders plot on the right. And we've had some success with this. In collaboration with experimentalists from the University of Cambridge, we've applied this reasoning to study this problem of stem cell decision making, asking what is the biological program that governs stem cell decision making, and can we use this to enhance the efficiency of cellular reprogramming? And this is the basic workflow. We take the data from the experimentalists and we use this to construct an abstract Boolean network. And then we can use RAIN, in addition to other data that those experimentalists can provide, to synthesize the set of models that are consistent. And that describes our biological program. And the important thing about this is that we can use it to be predictive. So as a very first step, here's the starting network that we started with. And you can see here, this encodes 10 to the 23 unique models. So that's quite a lot of models. And by encoding experimental specifications, we were able to reduce this to a set of models that had only 10 to the 6 concrete networks. And so the first thing this can tell us is which interactions between genes are key. You know, which interactions are present in every single one of those networks, or interestingly, which interactions never appear. And that's very valuable to experimentalists. But interestingly, we can also encode and test the satisfiability of new hypotheses. So we generate hypothetical specifications and use those to formulate predictions of untested behavior. And crucially, because of our approach, we can test it against all of the models. So at no point do we ever have to kind of delve in and just pick our favorite one. We can always work with this set that are consistent with the data. And I don't want you to worry too much about the information on the plots, but this is useful for me to point out how we've approached this problem of reprogramming. So by looking at the trajectories of these networks, we were able to generate predictions about how we could introduce factors into this system that might increase the efficiency of reprogramming by reducing the number of steps it takes to reach the embryonic state. And then we can test this experimentally and find that there's really great agreement between the models and the experiment, showing that we've actually generated a system that it can explain what we've already seen and predict what we haven't yet seen. So this kind of summarizes some of the success that we've had in this, that we've been able to generate a biological program that governs cellular reprogramming. And we constrained it, first of all, against 44 experimental constraints. And I don't know whether or not people here will think that sounds like many, but for someone in my position in doing what I do, that's a really, first of all, that's a very large number of experiments to show that your model's consistent with. And then to be able to say, well, actually, this approach has allowed us to influence how we approach reprogramming. And actually, we've been able to improve reprogramming efficiency by a factor of 100 and reduce the time it takes from 1 to 2 weeks to just 24 hours. So it's really demonstrating the power of the approach. And then this is all encompassing a set of predictions that we're able to make. 132 correct predictions were made, and these encompass genetic perturbations and the kinetics of gene activation throughout this reprogramming trajectory. So we've also had success in communicating this research externally, and we've published some of this work in some high-impact journals, which is showing that it's also resonating with the community and that they're actually willing and excited about using these approaches more widely across biology. Because as I've described it, this is, you know, all about stem cells, but actually this kind of approach can be used to study different aspects of biology, like the cell cycle or cell death or cell migration. And more generally, this is all getting encompassed in what we call a platform for programming biology. I'm part of a really exciting group at Microsoft AI and Research in Cambridge called the Biological Computation Group. And we're interested in developing both the analytics and the tools that could be necessary to program, well, design and program biological systems. And so as a researcher, all that's left for me to do really is to acknowledge all of my colleagues who've worked on this. You know, it's always a collaborative effort in science, and so it's very important to say I'm just a cog in that machine. Amazing collaborators from Cambridge, Amy, Graziano, and Austin, from Microsoft Research, and also external collaborators, Boyan, Hillel, and Stephen, and more generally, the Biological Computation Group. So thank you very much for your time.